Hi, this is For the Love of Learning with Christine DiDomenico and myself, Simone Padour. And today we're going to talk about listening to your kids. So, Christine, you had what usually happens to me today
with, yeah.
with stuff coming up just before the show topic. So do you want to let us know what's going on?
Well, I was having a conversation with my son and he was all wrapped up in his drama and, you know, we were just going at it. It was lovely. And he said, "You don't listen." And, you know, and then I was thinking about it when I got home and I was like, oh, that's our topic for today. Listening to your children, how appropriate, which as you said, happens quite often in our worlds. So, yeah. And I really got this the other day, we were in the car too, when he was having a little bit of drama around anxiety and he knows the access tools and uses them and doesn't use them as we do. And, so he was asking me to ask him questions and I was going to clearings. I was asking questions and doing clearings and that is not what he was looking for. He really wanted me to have a little bit of a conversation with him and stop using the access tools and help him have more awareness around what was going on, but not in a what he was sensing my making him wrong. And it was true. It was there was when I looked at it, I realized that I had a lot of judgments attached to my questions. I had a lot of conclusions attached to my questions. And I wasn't really tapping into the energy of what he required. And so I asked the question, what question can I ask that would give me, well, I gave him the question, what question can I ask to give me clarity with this? But I asked for myself, what question can I ask that would contribute to him? And what I got from that was that I just needed to have a conversation with him and sometimes not even have a conversation, but just listen. Just listen with putting my barriers down, not having a point of view, not having to fix it for him, as we parents want to do, but just listen with no point of view, which as a parent is not always difficult to do. It's not always easy, I should say, to do. And it's amazing how it can change things without having to say a word. And I know that. So knock, knock. How many times do I have to bang my head against the wall before I remember?
Yeah. Well, and like, this is something that I've been practicing on and off when I remember is that when I am talking to somebody, so often I go to, oh, well, what is my story that relates to this? Or what information do I have, blah, 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 in my head? And instead of, as you say, just sitting there and just listening and just being present. And we had a guest on that actually is really good at that, Daria. And I remember her doing this and she would say what she was going to say and then stop. And it was, I found it such an invitation to then either speak or ask more questions. Actually, ask more questions is really what came up for me. And so I wonder, like, by the willingness to listen and actually shut up, which I have to say is one of the most difficult things for me to do, you know, what could we create? So, yeah. I'm reminded also of I made the demand of myself to do that for 7 days was visiting my brother, and I was like, what would it take for me to just listen and be present and not have to yap at him all the time? Because I'm really good at yapping. It's like a small dog. And so I did. And he talked to me about things and shared things with me that I didn't know about him and that I had no clue, you know? But I had given him the space in order to be, where before I was so uncomfortable with being that vulnerable and just shutting up that I would just talk all the time and he couldn't get a word in edgewise. And you could actually see him stop being present because I was just yapping. So,
well, that's funny because I had an experience last night with in a social setting where one of the people was just talking and talking and talking and talking and talking and not at all being present with anyone else or being aware at all that anyone else wanted to say anything either. And I, you know, it really gave me the awareness for myself too of where I might do that also. And how it just like turns people off to even receiving anything from you when you're not present, even with what you're saying.
Yeah.
And we're really not being present when we have a judgment attached or a conclusion attached.
Yeah, because you were already going to that story you have in your head about, you know, the judgment or the blah, blah, blah. Side note, I had this colleague who, he was a bit of an elf. And there was this other woman that taught with us, and there were certain key words that if you said them, it was like Pavlov's dogs. Like you'd feed her the word and she'd give you that story that matched that word every time. And so
about that.
Well, like he used to say something about, I think it was humidity. And she would go on about, you know, this particular story about how it was humid in this area. And he would play the game to see how many times you could get her to tell the same story by that word.
Oh my gosh. That's very funny. So just shifting over to kids and school a little bit. I have been taken on a job of supervising student teachers this semester. And yeah, it's been really fun. And I love that it kind of keeps me on top of what's going on in the classroom since I retired. And I just love contributing to the young minds and also receiving from them too, so much. Mm-hmm. And at one of the schools I went to, and this is physical education, it was a city school with, I don't know, there must have been 80 girls in the gym, at least, maybe more. And they are playing ultimate football, which is American football, but it's kind of like, if you know ultimate frisbee, it's like kind of like a keep away game using a football in this case. And it's a team sport. And so you have 11th and 12th grade girls that do not want to, first of all, they do not want to be changing their clothes. So they put their clothes over, they put their phys ed uniform over the clothes that they wore to school. And so that was one thing, like, what are we not listening to with this behavior, you know, with the choices that they're making of putting their phys ed clothes over their clothes? What are we not hearing? What are we not listening to? And the student teacher pointed out to me that the girls don't want to be playing ultimate football. They don't. It's not fun for them. It's not interesting. It's just crazy that this is something that's part of their curriculum. But somewhere they decided that this is what they're going to do. And so then the kids are made wrong for not participating, not wanting to participate, try to get out of it. And you create such a difficulty and struggle because we're not listening to kids, what kids actually would like.
Yeah.
And one of the teachers actually had said that if she could take them to the local gym, they would love that. You know, a lot of them go there anyway. So what if that was part of their phys ed program, you know, teaching them the proper technique and using the gym that they like to go to as part of their PE program. It's like, it's really obvious in some instances where obvious to me anyway, where we're not listening to what kids would like.
Yeah. Well, and I remember when I was teaching overseas, like in the Middle East, like I was very curious because I had always taught at an alternative school. So I was really curious to see how the other staff interacted with the kids. And because they really didn't speak much English to start with, particularly the little ones and even the older ones, some of them struggled to see what these Western teachers would do. I would have been really fortunate that I'd been in French immersion and stuff. So I had this sort of sense of it. And some of them were amazing. Like they recognized that these kids were really high energy, more than I had ever experienced in any school, and loud, like I'd never experienced in any other school. And some of them just like channeled that beautifully. And then others just fought with it. And I was amazed to see, you know, like, and it was really, in my interesting point of view, kind of sad when other teachers would be like, oh, these kids are so stupid and blah, blah, blah. And back in my home country, blah, 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 blah. And then other teachers that didn't have that point of view that are like, okay, let's work with these kids. What do these kids know? And what are they good at? And all of a sudden, you know, these kids became like superstars. And, you know, you may argue, well, you know, that class was particularly good or something like that. But I actually saw a class that were mental cases. Like their teacher had no control. They got locked out of the classroom like numerous times. And there was just this chaos, endless chaos that was occurring and no learning was happening. And that teacher finally stepped down. She's like, I can't do this. You know, I'm better with working, you know, one-on-one tutoring type stuff. So she changed jobs and this new teacher came in, turned these kids around within 2 weeks, you know, and these were kids that were, you know, damaging, not damaging school property, but littering and not caring about their surroundings. And, you know, within a few weeks time, they had like organized themselves for like litter pickup. And they're like, let's be proud of our school. And it's important to the environment. And yeah.
So what was different do you get?
She was willing to listen to them. I mean, she was very strict, but she also listened to, you know, what they were interested in, listened to where they were struggling. And she never had the point of view that they were dumb. They just, you know, might need extra help in some area. And she watched and observed like how they learned and what support they needed, if any. So this listening thing, you know.
Yeah. I mean, the behavior is an indication of something. It's not just that they're bad or because so many teachers just label. I've seen whole classes of kids, not like a whole grade of kids labeled as, oh no, this group, they're coming to the middle school. They've been so bad. And so we attach these projections to the kids and then guess what they do? They just act that right out. Our point of view creates our reality. So we have the point of view that they're going to be a bad class and then they come in and that's exactly what they give us. So changing our point of view or even asking a question like what else is possible can change how the kids show up.
Absolutely. Well, and that particular teacher, because I was fascinated with what she did, and I said, and I sort of did a little interview, and I was like, what makes you different? Like, what are you doing? And she'd never done the access or anything, but she said to me, well, you know, that happened to me as a kid. I was labeled and nobody would listen to me. And for years, she said, I was this bad kid. And she said, it was just one teacher who took a dislike to me. And she said, I never did anything bad. I didn't get in trouble, but they just decided. And then, you know, I mean, teachers talk in the staff room and stuff, and it gets passed. Well, you better watch so-and-so because they're blah, 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 blah. And the next thing you know, this kid has a stigma attached to them. Which is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It is kind of crazy. And we talked to Tiffany Thien last week, and she was talking about how her classroom, the kids changed, their scores changed because she did listen to them. And she did, you know, tap into what those kids required and gave them tools to look at things from a different possibility, because they start thinking those things about themselves. You know, with the labels, and there are advantages to having the labels because you can use that to your advantage. But yeah, when they're made wrong, when the label is a wrongness, then it's tough for them to get out of that. And I've probably said this before, but my son told me when he graduated high school that when he was diagnosed with ADHD at the age of 8, the teachers started treating him like he was dumb. Mm-hmm. And that was such an eye opener for me, to acknowledge that that is what we do. We often slow things down for a kid that actually needs to have things sped up, and we have all kinds of decisions about what they need or how we have to teach or how we have to deal with them, which may or may not have anything to do with that particular kid. Because even with the labels, not every kid is the same. A kid that with autism is not the same as the other kid with autism. A kid with ADHD is not the same as another kid with ADHD.
Yeah, I remember working at a small school and we really only had sort of one labeled autistic kid. And we had other autistic kids, but they weren't labeled. And so another kid who was labeled autistic came and they're like, oh, great, they can be friends. And I was like, I'm not sure that because they're autistic, they're going to be friends. Yeah. And the other thing about listening that occurred to me while you were talking was that kids are different, just like us, from day to day. So we need to listen to who they are that day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true. Very true. And that's what I saw today, too, was yesterday was one situation with my son. Today was a completely different situation.
Yeah.
Which I was trying to deal with the same way.
Yeah.
So that's where those damn questions are quite valuable.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say the question, what does he require from me today? What contribution can I be to him today? Those are great questions.
Yeah. Or who are they today?
Yeah. That's a really good question. Especially with my son. Who are you today? Who's showing up?
Yeah. I know I've often referred to horses and kids in the same breath, just because I find that they're so similar in that they're willing to change on a dime all the time. And they facilitate you to things that you have asked for that you didn't necessarily say out loud sometimes. And today, as I was telling Christine just before we started, I was riding this horse without a bridle, without a saddle. Just, I had a neck strap around his neck and, you know, my only control was my legs. And he was like, no, I'm not listening to your legs this week. Nope. So I literally had to like stick my leg out next to the, let's say he was going, I wanted him to go left. I'd have to stick my leg out next to his right leg so that he actually had trouble moving that way. And that's how firm I had to be with him, because otherwise he would just take the Mickey and just wander wherever he wanted to. I find like with these tools, there are sometimes that it's intensely uncomfortable and you are feel very vulnerable, like you're an egg without a shell. Because it's venturing out and doing something unknown a lot of the time. And instead of, you know, we talked about those people who get on the conversation and they just repeat the same tapes that they had for, you know, however 50, 60 years or whatever it is. And you can't, they'll just say the same thing. Whereas if you want to deal with kids, particularly if they're special ed or on the spectrum, you cannot do that. Because they'll switch off or they'll show you with their behavior, and I am not doing this. And I'm not listening to you because you're boring. And they'll tell you that too. I've had that.
Yes. Yes. So why don't we talk about some of those behaviors and what they can be telling us sometimes. Like, I always think of the flapping of the arms with kids with autism. That's something that I'm not sure if they're still doing this, but it's been something that they try to stop the kid from doing. They call it stimming. And so what is that? Like asking a question, what is that for that kid? And it can often be a way that they deal with all the stimulation, everything they're perceiving and sensing, and a way to dissipate that energy so that they can actually be more present.
Yeah, I know I watched, I think it's called Beyond Words. It's a documentary that Access has just done. And there's a beautiful piece of it with Delaney and Glenn Shepherd. And he talks about what he loves about being out in nature or being in Access classes is the information overload that he usually gets. And, you know, and he says, you know, he moves or he flaps his hands or he makes noise. He said, because it's so intense coming into him, that he has to dissipate it somehow. Otherwise, he says it's almost painful, or maybe it is painful. I mean, I haven't really been in his situation. So that's the way he does it. But when people don't have that constant stuff in their head, and I've experienced this very lately, I spent some time with someone that, you know, really hasn't done any Access classes at all. And I could feel the intensity, like being pushed up against my face and my head, you know, because it's not just that they're talking out here, they're talking in their head. And it's just like, and after a few hours, you're just like, I just want to like go for a walk or be by myself or, you know. So I have a mild case of, you know, what people talk about. So I get it. And what are some of the tools that we can use to contribute to these kids?
Yeah. And not really having a point of view about it, like not making that hand flapping wrong. Or I was watching a video of a woman who I worked with. Her son is, I don't know, maybe 4. And they were videotaping him going to bed. And he didn't have his Superman pajamas. And he was so upset because he didn't have his Superman pajamas. And he said, "You're making me upset without my Superman." And they were in the wash. And that's why he didn't have his Superman pajamas. And I thought, well, I wonder what it would take to just take them out of the wash, even dirty, and let him wear them dirty. Like if that would allow him to go to sleep, which would contribute to him as a parent. Now we've dissipated this whole, you know, upset and we can get on with our night. But there's a point of view that you can't wear dirty pajamas. I mean, I don't know how dirty they were. If they were soiled with urine or something like that, I don't know whether I would want to do that. But if they're just because he's worn them a night or two nights or whatever, then what would it take to just let him wear, listen to him and wear the pajamas? Superman pajamas.
Well, and like I have my niece and nephew, like they have 2 sets of their snuggly toy, you know, that they can't go to sleep without. So that, you know, when one snuggly toy is dirty, they just switch it and they're identical. Mm-hmm. And it's not a problem, right?
That's great.
Which I think is brilliant. I had the same thing with food as a child. Like, my mom was a health nut, and she tried, still is a health nut, she tried to make me eat food that I didn't want. And eventually she realized that this was a battle that did not need to be fought. And she just made me food that I liked. I was a healthy kid, you know, ran around and stuff like that. But I wouldn't eat anything with sauce. I would only eat raw carrots. I would eat pasta, and I would eat European wieners. And that's pretty much it as far as, you know, dinner, lunch food. And I had to have eggs. Like, they had to be boiled to a certain consistency. They couldn't have that runny white stuff. And they had to be chopped up with toast in a mug. Otherwise, I would not eat eggs. So, I mean, thank God my mom was willing to do this, because I think I just wouldn't have eaten, because mm-hmm. that was that stubborn. So, you know, like, it, as you say, like, is it worth the battle? Like, choose your battles.
It's
really, I guess, where I would go with this.
Well, and food is such a huge area where we don't listen to our children. And what if they actually know what their body requires? And what if it has nothing to do with the nutritional guidelines that's, I don't even know who created, but that, you know, they'll often eat a little bit and not want any more. And how many people make them finish everything on the plate?
Yes.
Or, you know, and I sometimes have a difficult time with this when I take them out to eat and they order something and then they eat two bites of it. And I'm getting over this because I'm aware that they're just listening to their body. And that's a whole nother, you don't want to waste, you know, point of view to destroy and uncreate.
But
they really do listen to their bodies with food, with what they want to wear. My granddaughter comes off the bus every time I get her off the bus with no coat on. And she is perfectly happy with no coat on in the middle of winter. She's comfortable. So who says that she needs a coat to, you know, in the winter to walk from the bus to the house? And or she'll get sick. That's just a point of view. That is just a point of view.
Well, and people's bodies vary so much. Like, and you think about, like, people that can hold their breath underwater, you know, some people have this amazing capacity. I mean, sometimes it takes some training, or people that are just natural swimmers, or, you know, there is this sort of, everybody's different and everybody has different strengths and different, you know, so why would it be any different with food? You know?
Yeah,
it's very interesting to me. And the other thing that I find is, you know, there's such this concern about obesity throughout the world. Well, unless they don't have any food, and then it's not really a concern. but like, your granddaughters knowing how much their body would like to eat and when they're done is a huge gift. Where, you know, I was, well, they tried to teach me to finish what was on my plate. That didn't really work. But that idea that you have to, you know, finish everything that's on your plate, otherwise, you know, you won't get dessert or you won't. And that then carries on into adulthood, which is just crazy.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. And then people are obese because they're not listening. And we haven't been taught to listen to our body. So I wonder if we taught our kids and honored our kids as to what they know about their body and let them choose how much. You know, we can't always make many different meals. So this isn't about cutting yourself out as a parent. There could be choices. You know, you make a few things, you know, to put on the table and you have a choice of this or this or this tonight. And then they can choose. And if they don't choose to eat, they're not going to die. They're really not.
Yeah. I mean, I always used to like leftover night because then I got choice.
Yeah. You know? The smorgasbord.
Yeah. And truthfully, my body really likes to eat that way. Like Spanish tapas, like having little different tastes of different things is amazing. Mm. So yeah. And finding out what that is, but I mean, also for parents, like my mom did this for years is, you know, she'd be making the main meal and she knew I wasn't going to have any sauce. So, you know, she would put the chicken aside, cause I did branch out from European wieners eventually. She would put the meat to the side, or, you know, cook pasta as well as rice, you know, just to, you know, and I think that contributed a lot to me being then able to branch out and choose things, knowing that, you know, she was willing to give me what I required. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there wasn't that resistance from her too.
Yeah.
To what you were eating. And when we don't sense the resistance, then we can choose different. But if we as a parent are in resistance to what they're choosing, then they're just going to want more of that.
Yes. Yeah.
Feeding fuel to the fire, as I describe it.
Yeah.
And it keeps going instead of, all right, I'm not going to resist this anymore. And then, oh, now they choose something different.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've seen that with parents who, this particular woman that I know whose son has had a drug problem, and, you know, she's just been so wanting to control the outcome of it. And then finally did get to the point where, you know what, I know I don't have any control of this, and whatever he chooses, he's going to choose, even if that choice is him dying from the drugs. I mean, she really got to that point. And pretty recently, and she was telling me last night that he said to her, enough, I can't do this anymore. Like, wow. It really, I get that he's choosing something different now without that resistance in place.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah. And my sense too is just from watching parents and then having my own students and stuff like that is that sometimes the kids that we have in our lives are actually facilitating change for us.
Mm.
So like I had this young guy I was working with, and I mean, he is stubborn as all get out, like, and yeah, like we worked quite well together, and his mom was convinced that he had to be this certain way, or that he had to be an academic, and there was no way in hell that he was going down that path. And I was like, wow, like I wonder how many kids like are just like, hey, mom or dad, like, what if it could be different? Like, what if you could have fun? And what if it wasn't a big deal if I become a garbage truck man? I saw this beautiful story the other day of this little boy who loves recycling, and he's saving his money, and his parents are like, you know, well, you know, you should put this towards your education and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, nope, saving it for a garbage truck. You know, and he's only like 7, right? But like some kids, like they just know. And if we honor them and be like, you know what? Okay, what could I get from my kid? Like, what does he know? Or what does she know that maybe I'm not willing to know, or, you know, could make my life easier?
Yeah. Oh boy. That really brings up a lot around kids' choices as they move forward into their life of graduating. Well, when they're in school, I know with sports, often kids don't seem to have choices. Their parents force them often to participate in a particular activity or a particular sport, where the kid might not want to play a sport, period. I have seen kids that are just miserable in sports. Yet they love art. And so what if that actually would contribute more to their life and their future if they're participating in something that they love like that? And then, and then graduating high school and the choice to what to do next, which around where I live, the choice is pretty much you're going to college. I see a little bit less of this now that there's more kids going into particular training areas like cosmetology, mm-hmm. or, you know, being some kind of technician or something like that. But there's still kind of a stigma to not going to a good college.
Yeah.
And I do remember a guidance counselor saying to parents once, there is no good college for your child. There is a college that would be great for your child, but it might not be Harvard and it might not be Yale, yet it's going to be great for your child.
Yep. Yeah. And I've got two things. JP, who I love, who's this YouTube video guy, and he always takes the mickey out of all kinds of different people and things and yoga. And his latest one is he's talking about his college degree and how it has, you know, prepared him for nothing because everybody has the same college degree. And that's the thing, like listening to what's out there, listening to what employers are looking for. I've heard so many times that, you know, they get these young people, they employ them and they have no skills.
Yeah.
You know, they could write them maybe a nice essay, but they don't have the skills to, you know, go out and get a client or do the research required for maybe something they don't know how to do. So, you know, when my kids, my students, when they were getting ready for their, you know, college and stuff, I'm like, just be aware that this degree may not get you a job. You know, what other skills do you have that you would like to pursue? You know, maybe it is an apprenticeship. Maybe it is learning a trade. One of my favorite stories is Ed Sheeran talked about, you know, how his, you know, he started his music career and stuff. And his dad said, if you want to be a musician, don't go to college, get out there and start playing. Cause that's what you need. Yeah. You need the miles.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, he did that. And yeah, it was rough. And yeah, if you want to go into that business, you better be willing to stick it out because there's so many people that want to be in it.
Yeah.
It's highly competitive.
Yeah.
And he did. He just did whatever it took. And I remember seeing him before he was famous. He came to the school I worked at and played in our gym. And
cool.
Yeah, it was really cool. And I remember listening to this guy going, wow. Like, you know, when you just know, it's this kid's going to go somewhere. He was only 19 at the time.
Wow. That's very cool.
Yeah. And just the willingness, but having that. How cool to have a dad that was like, hey, you know, you may need to do something different.
Yeah, very cool. Well, one of my student teachers in our final conference talked just about that. He said, I asked him about his experience, you know, just to kind of get a sense of where he was at. And he said, this semester, this 16 weeks, I learned more than in 3.5 years of going to college.
Yep.
And he was amazing because he jumped in full force. He would go to special ed meetings. He would go, and one of the PE teacher he was working with did some administrative things when the administrator was out, and he went and helped her do that. And he went to the local Wendy's to sell hamburgers when they had a fundraiser event going on there. He put himself full force into the teaching experience. And he got, I think, more out of it than any of my other student teachers because he did immerse himself in and he learned so much. He learned so much about kids, about all the responsibilities of teaching. And so what would it take to have more of that in college than the reading, writing, book, you know, crap?
Yeah. Sorry. Well, I mean, I remember my own like student teacher days and having professors that had never been a teacher teaching us.
Yeah.
How they had never been in a classroom.
Wow.
And then I was like, how the heck are you supposed to know what I need or what I need to do? And I remember also being really impressed with two of my teachers, actually, that I really adored, one of which had taught in some of the roughest schools in the U.S. I mean, there was one school she taught in where kids would carve their own, they were like a cricket bat for their own beatings at this particular school. I mean, obviously this was a while ago, but you know, just things that she taught, you know, like inner city New York, you know, where scissors weren't allowed. She was an art teacher. And she was so amazing because she really listened to us and she asked us what we required. So I remember in our, I think it was our last semester, semester before, she said, okay, what is going to make your life easier? What do you require to create or do or prepare for? Because we were going to be teaching full time 5 days a week. And I said, you know what would be really great is if we could have a project where we had to create a unit and create all the lessons within the unit and get all our research together and all our material. And she said, do it. So that's what we did, is all of us teachers went out and did that. Wow. And it was such a contribution, you know, instead of writing another report about the motor skills and Piaget's blah, 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 you know, we actually had concrete resources that we could then use, which I've used over and over and over again since. And the other teacher I had was a psychology of education teacher, and she was still teaching in high school, even though she was teaching at university, because she knew that in order to teach us, she needed to keep her finger on the pulse of what was going on for kids. Because if you taught like 40 years ago, I'm exaggerating.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's totally different.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, you know? Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this student teacher supervisor, because I do want to stay on the pulse of what's going on, because it really, like you said, it does change a lot, and kids change a lot. What I used to see in a fifth grader when I first started teaching fifth grade in 2003 is very different now. Very different. Yeah. They're completely different than they were in 2003. And that's not that long ago.
No.
Yeah.
No. Well, I wonder too, and this, like, I'm looking at the curriculum that, you know, that I may be teaching this autumn, and I'm wondering, like, how much, you know, obviously there's social media and there's, you know, all of that stuff that kids are, you know, can't get away from. It's just there. But also the curriculum, like what I would have learned in, you know, third grade, kids are learning in like kindergarten and first grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, how did they even get those concepts? Like, I was just like, can I play? Can I play now? How about now? And that just boggles my mind. Like, we're pushing these kids, like my niece, like her dad was like pushing this kid to learn her alphabet. She's like, I don't know, 2.5 or something like that. And like really being like, okay, what's that color? And I'm just like, leave the kid alone. Like,
yes.
Then after looking at this curriculum, I'm like, wow, like if she doesn't know that by the time she hits kindergarten, you know, or early years, whatever they call it, because they start a lot earlier here, you know, she's going to be behind. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's worried about.
Yeah. Yeah. It is amazing. My son-in-law was telling me the other day how he was trying to help his daughter with her math, and he didn't know how to help her with fifth grade math because it's being taught in a very different way than we were taught also. But, and I think we had this conversation because I really go to that point of view too, that, oh my gosh, we're pushing them so much. And I wonder if we didn't have that point of view, I wonder how much they actually can receive that's much greater than we acknowledge.
Yeah. I think where I get stuck is when it's done in such a rote mm-hmm. environment, like you will yeah. repeat this until it is in your head. Well, you know what? I will be out of my head, mm-hmm. you know, like, cause I know from, you know, teaching at APS, like we were watching science programs that I was struggling to understand because they were talking about, you know, bionomes. I don't know if that's a real thing, but, and genetics and like the kids were just like sucking it up. You could just see it on their faces. And the more complex the science got, the more they were into it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when I try to show them kiddie science, they're like, really, you know? So I think as long as we listen and we mm-hmm. ask questions, because I mean, if I had done them, I don't want to say done that to them, but that's not the case. If I had, you know, insisted that they do English at the same level that they wanted to do science,
mm-hmm.
they would have totally balked and been like, what are you doing?
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, and I think that's where we're so much in a box with education that, you know, third grade is this, this, and this in every subject. Instead of like what we did with the Access Possibility, a kid could be in fourth grade social studies and in seventh grade math, which is yeah. really, really beautiful. And what would it take to have education be that for all kids?
Well, and I know it's possible because, I mean, I've taught in, you know, multi-age, multi-level skill, blah, blah, classrooms where, you know, one kid might be struggling to write their name. And the other one is, you know, painting the next, you know, Da Vinci, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, they could be the, whatchamacallit, forger, you know, in a matter of minutes. So, you know, my sense is finding that sort of common ground with all the kids. But then again, you have to be willing to ask questions. You have to be willing to listen. And I think what I've learned most out of my teaching experience so far is finding lessons that ask those questions.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you are just doing everything by rote, you'll just go, oh, well, little Freddie is not going to pass this. And little Alice, well, she's got an A star in that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know that little Freddie might be really good at, you know, abstract algebra, and Alice, you know, may suck at it because you haven't got there yet. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It opens yep. the doors to so many other possibilities. And, you know, as we talk, it's not about making anything that you're doing wrong. It's mm-hmm. really about inviting you to ask questions, to have that awareness show up to,
yep.
the possibility that there's a different way of doing things. Cause I'm sure a lot of teachers will say, but I have this many students, and yes. And I wonder what else is possible.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder yeah. how kids can contribute to each other in their yeah. learning and teaching each other, and how one of my student teachers was using one of the kids in kindergarten who had some quote difficult behaviors to be a leader and to help set up equipment and teach other kids, because they would come on different days. It was never like all the kids yeah. come on the same day. So he would have a lesson that the kids were getting. He already had it. So now he could help be the teacher. And yeah, that exactly. helped so much in having him not running around wild around the gym, but being a contribution and being a part of the yeah. class and really being engaged.
Yeah. Well, and I find the willingness to listen, like Tiffany was talking about last week, invites your students to have your back and to contribute to you. And that willingness to have them teach the class gives them such a boost. Like, I know how to do this. Like, I can do this. And I know from tutoring my peers, because I did that a little bit in university, was that I learned the information so much better when I had to teach it to somebody else.
Yeah.
Because it's a totally different way of using your brain.
Mm-hmm. That's a great idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
That really is.
Yeah, for sure. And I also wonder too, because I know we do this so often, is like, you know, you hear something great and then you throw everything out that you used to do. And you're like, no, this is the best thing since sliced bread. But I wonder if we could also look at what do we do already really well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what could we add to it?
Yeah. That acknowledgement is really big in creating something different, and those things that you've used may be very appropriate for some kids and not so appropriate for other kids.
Yeah.
To meet their needs.
Yeah. And that willingness to be in the question actually gives you the flexibility. Cause I know what you're saying about, you know, kids that have, you know, 30, 40 kids, depending on where you are. Tiffany was saying something about 60 if you like 10 years ago or something. That's just crazy to me.
Yeah.
And like, I found like teaching a kid, you know, a group of kids, young kids of, you know, 30 in the class, if I was willing to stay in the question and ask them questions and give them choices and stuff, it was easier than if I had tried to be the dictator. Cause I watched colleagues try and do that. And it's not an easy job and it's exhausting.
It is exhausting. Cause I used to be that.
You can attest to that.
Yes, it really was. It is exhausting. And I see it with my student teachers too. And when this one young man was in a middle school with, I don't know, there had to be 120 kids in the gym. And it was a dictatorship. I felt like I was in the 1940s. I didn't exist in the 1940s in this body anyway, but I would see these videos of them doing calisthenics in rows all together. And this is what they were actually doing. And I thought, there's got to be a different possibility. I know there's a different possibility, a different way to do this that may very much look like a total chaotic atmosphere, and it actually would work better for the teachers. They could be more relaxed, and for the students to get more out of it. Because I know there's a lot of people that would come in my gym that were other subject teachers or administrators, and they couldn't even be in there. It was, to them, it was chaotic. To me, it was chaos. You know, it was controlled chaos, basically.
Yeah.
It, you know, everybody knew what they were supposed to be doing, and they had choices, and they were all engaged and doing something that was contributing to them. But it sure did look like chaos to everybody else, and they couldn't handle that.
I remember I had to go up in front of a panel of teachers that I was working in primary, and it was kindergarten teachers. And I used to travel from classroom to classroom. It was quite the setup. I had those, you know, those trolleys that you get in IKEA. I had one of those.
Yeah.
And I had two plastic boxes, probably a foot each or foot and a half each, stacked on top of each other with all my supplies in it. Paint, you name it. I had everything in my little kit. And I would come into different classrooms, and I had like plastic fold-out sheets for all the tables and all that stuff. And these teachers, the system there was very sort of old school, you know, kids had worksheets and they did it a certain way, and like da 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 da. And, you know, here this art teacher would come in and they'd create things, and there would be mess, and there would be paper, and there would be paint, and kids that had choices, and, you know, all of this stuff. And they were like, why are we doing this? There's no point to this, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, and I always made the best effort to clean up, you know, any messes that were made or whatever. And, so I went before them and I said, look, here are some of the, you know, exhibits of what we're doing. You know, here's an example of such and such. And it also includes geometry. This one also includes vocabulary. So they started to see that, you know, their kids, it was just a different way of accessing these subjects that they were already teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great because it brought, you know, a lot of people would have gone in there and like had to prove their point. And I was just like, this is what I do. And they were like, oh, okay. so you're actually supporting what I'm doing. And I was like, yes. And then they would start telling me, like, oh, I'm doing this science lesson. Do you think you could do something on crocodiles? Or, you know, so then it became much more of a contribution to each other rather than just me coming in and them freaking out with the kids.
That's cool. That's very cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
You were breaking down the resistance.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And I often saw that with all the requirements that teachers have, you know, they have a lot of pressure on them to, for their kids to meet these certain standards. And in my point of view, it's making it more difficult to meet the standards because of the way that, things are being taught and that pressure that teachers feel that I have to do this in order to get them here. When if we actually listen, so if you're going through your day and the kids are fried and you keep pushing through your lesson, how much is that contributing to them receiving more? Or if they just totally shut down, and what if 3 minutes of moving around the classroom would change the whole atmosphere and what they can receive?
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, and there's so many different like movement activities and stuff that you can still do and still learn things that it's amazing. You know, like I've seen these amazing like math games and stuff like that where kids get to run away, or punctuation. I think it's called punctuation karate or something like that.
Cool.
And it could be that they might, like some of the really good teachers that I've worked with, like, you know, their kids would be fried and they're like, okay, you know what? Let's just turn the lights out for a minute. Put your head on the table and just relax. And yeah, after about 5 minutes, they would be like, oh, I can do this. You know, I can do some more.
It doesn't take much. Yeah. So we're almost out of time. So
as usual.
Yeah, I know. Time flies. So for our listeners, we have lots and lots of archived shows that you can listen to at blogtalkradio.com/for the love of learning. And next week we have Kristen Trombel. Kristen's an Access Consciousness facilitator, and she is going to talk about social anxiety.
Ooh,
a topic we have not delved into at all.
No, we have not.
About that.
We also have a Pinterest site where we have a lot of our archive shows, and we also have different tidbits from different guests that we have on. So, you know, YouTube videos that they've done, or their websites, or just random mix of things. So if you want to check out more of what they do and you can see it, and it's just called For the Love of Learning, and it's on Pinterest. And love, just so everybody knows, is L-U-V.
Thank you for that clarification. That would be an important one.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks, Simone. It's always fun.
Yes, it is. Thanks, Christine.
Bye-bye.